headlines. Yemeni officials slammed Saudi Arabia for refusing to allow three fuel ships to dock in Hodeidah port despite securing UN clearance. Iraq's Prime Minister orders an investigation into the violence which erupted during Friday's protest against parliamentary election results. And British police clash with anti-establishment protesters and make at least a dozen arrests during the annual Million Mask March in London. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Yemen's petroleum company has slammed Saudi Arabia for its refusal to allow three ships carrying fuel to dock in Hodeidah port. In a statement, the company says the Saudi-led coalition seized the tankers nearly 3 months ago, despite the vessels having secured UN clearance for sailing in international waters. It says that the country is in need of fuel to continue its public services. Yemen has been mired in war and blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia since 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people and has destroyed its vital infrastructure. The UN says more than 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, calling the situation there the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The West's all-out support for Saudi Arabia does not seem to be subsiding. That's amid concerns by anti-war and human rights organizations that the Saudi regime uses all the support to press ahead with its now years-long deadly aggression against Yemen and its civilian population.
The United States has approved a potential weapons sale worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Saudi Arabia. On Thursday, the Pentagon said the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles was approved by the State Department in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The State Department said the sale is fully consistent with the administration's pledge to co-lead with diplomacy to end the conflict in Yemen while also ensuring Saudi Arabia has the means to defend itself. Yemen's Ansarullah movement reacted, saying the arms sales prove that U.S. administration has no real intention to stop the Saudi onslaught on Yemen. This is seen as the first major arms sale to Riyadh since President Joe Biden took the helm at the White House. But such weapons transfer is not limited to the current administration. In May 2017, former President Donald Trump signed a mega weapons sales deal worth $110 billion in a meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The recent deals have made Saudi Arabia become the largest importer of American arms and munitions. According to a report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, 1/4 of America's arms exports go directly to the kingdom. The report also says that between 2016 and 2020, Saudi weapons purchases only from the United States accounted for 79% of the country's total arms imports. Many believe the U.S. weapons sales to Saudi Arabia serves no one but arms manufacturing companies.
These are offensive weapons to be used against the resistance in Yemen, so it should absolutely be condemned. And the violation of President Biden promising to lead with diplomacy, and once again, its weapons sales, which benefit Raytheon and benefit the Saudi monarchy, but no one else.
But the United States is not the only country that provides Saudis with weapons. The UK, Canada, Spain, France, Italy, and Germany are among other major exporters of weapons to the Al Saud dynasty. The arms supplies to Saudi Arabia have already sparked global criticism, given the kingdom's devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. Anti-war and human rights organizations have long sounded the alarm over the loss of human lives as a result of the West-backed Saudi aggression on Yemen. It seems the U.S. and its Western allies have no concern for misery the Saudi-led coalition have been inflicting on Yemenis. They are rather concerned about petrodollars they receive in return for those weapons being used in the impoverished Arab country.
On to Iraq, where the Prime Minister there has ordered an investigation into the violence which erupted during Friday's protest against parliamentary election results. Mustafa al-Kadhimi announced the formation of a committee to look into clashes during demonstrations in Baghdad. The committee will try to uncover the circumstances surrounding the deaths and injuries of protesters, as well as security forces. Meanwhile, senior Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr said that the people should hold street protests against the election results in a peaceful manner. In a tweet, he noted that such rallies should not lead to violence and the humiliation of the government. Iraqis have held several rallies against the vote outcome that initially put the Saad bloc in the lead. Iraq's Fatah alliance said international observers recorded numerous violations during the voting process and counting. The federal court is yet to certify the final results. Iran says its proposed resolution on nuclear disarmament serves as a benchmark for measuring the actions of UN members against their claims. In a statement, Iran's ambassador to the UN said that any negative vote by Western countries to Iran's proposal would expose their hypocrisy. Majid Takht-Ravanchi said that the West has always turned a blind eye to Israel's arsenal of weapons of mass destruction and instead pointed fingers at Iran over nuclear proliferation. Takht-Ravanchi underscored Iran's policy that WMDs, including nuclear arms, undermine global security, and a safe and secure world requires the annihilation of such weapons. The UN General Assembly First Committee approved Iran's draft resolution last week. The Assembly is expected to vote for its final adoption in about a month. Political commentator Lawrence Davidson says that Israel is not only an obstacle to nuclear disarmament, but a threat to global security.
The United States will dismiss it as a ploy. They will say that Iran is trying to get nuclear weapons and at the same time trying to promote non-proliferation, and that's a contradiction. I'm pretty sure that's going to be their reaction. And of course, what the West will do, at least the United States, will try to change the subject or redirect the target of the effort to expose their own hypocrisy. See, so I think it's a good resolution. I think we need to be reminded repeatedly of this predicament with nuclear weapons and the fact that Israel, in so many ways, stands as an obstacle to progress, not only with nuclear weapons, and also but with international law generally.
An anti-establishment demonstration has turned violent in the British capital, with police clashing with protesters in central London. At least 8 officers were injured during scuffles in Parliament Square. The Metropolitan Police said that 12 people were arrested. Demonstrators wearing masks gathered at nearby Trafalgar Square, with some throwing Molotov cocktails at the officers. They also burnt an effigy of Prime Minister Boris Johnson in a show of anger at his policies. November 5th marks an annual Million Mask March, which draws massive rallies against government overreach, income inequality, and more recently, COVID-19 restrictions.
Hundreds of anti-establishment protesters linked to the global hacktivist group Anonymous near the British Houses of Parliament under heavy police presence in a demonstration dubbed the Million Mask March.
They had a long list of grievances, from the government's performance on the climate crisis to its response to the pandemic to infringement of civil liberties, as well as its support for military intervention abroad.
It's all corruption. It's all fakery as well. They benefit from wars. We don't. We wouldn't have a war. All of these Senate halves and everything, yeah, we care about the people of our families who have died, but none of these people would have voted for any war, any war. The governments do that, and we have to go around, you know, like, praising them up or doing what they say. No. No.
The event happens on the same date every year, the 5th of November, a date associated with an attempted attack on Parliament in 1605. But instead of the traditional burning of an effigy of one of the culprits by the name of Guy Fawkes and a bonfire each year, the group don masks made popular by the novel and movie V for Vendetta. They say they're symbolic of standing up to power. They also wear them to protect their identities, to remain anonymous. To their supporters, they're freedom fighters or digital Robin Hoods. Among the crowd, the Palestinian flag, and supporters of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, jailed in the UK.
As you've seen with Julian's case, it's the judiciary system. The whole system is corrupt from the roots. You have political prisoners. You have a war on the free press and independent journalists. I know a journalist here who's been arrested before just for filming the police, their criminality. We're not, if anyone thinks we live in a democracy, they really need to wake up. They need to wake up. We're not in a democracy. Democracy has several pillars. One of them is free press. One of them is the right to assemble, free speech. All of these are dead.
The mostly peaceful Million Mask March started in 2003 and has grown bigger in number. A grassroots group that says it aims to shed light on government corruption and protect liberty. Saeed Puruza, London.
France's healthcare used to be the envy of the world, but austerity cuts have rapidly caused it to plummet in international rankings. A new report says 20% of hospital beds across France have closed since the start of COVID-19. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
France has been shocked by a report which found that 20% of all the nation's hospital beds have been closed since the start of the pandemic. That total number of closed beds is twice as many as in 2019, which also reveals that hospitals have been running at under capacity for some time. Unions gathered to clarify the situation, and they said it's even worse than it seems. The 20% number includes private hospitals, but it's public hospitals which have seen their funding cut almost annually since 2009.
As recently as the year 2000, France's medical system was ranked number one in the world by the United Nations. That claim can no longer be made following more than a decade of austerity, and perhaps no group has protested as often in recent years as medical professionals.
We absolutely can't talk about France having the best healthcare system in the world anymore, not when we can't even take decent care of people who are already dying. People are dying in atrocious conditions. It's not because nurses are negligent, but because we are overworked and because our current politicians don't care about the health of the people.
It's not only the lack of resources which is keeping hospitals underutilized or even closed, but also a lack of medical personnel. Studies show that during the age of austerity, public jobs, once eliminated, are not returning, even in hospitals during a once-in-a-century pandemic. What unions repeatedly accused is that the coronavirus is being instrumentalized by France's neoliberals to accelerate their open and long-standing goal of defunding public services even amid the corona instability.
We have this conviction that the government is manipulating corona because they were forcing the cuts before corona. Only the cuts are now coming even faster. In the middle of a pandemic, hospitals are being closed and services are no longer being offered, from our biggest and best public hospitals to smaller ones.
For public medical professionals, working conditions and pressures have dramatically worsened over the last 20 months, causing many to quit and turn over to the private sector. Unions say many of those resigned posts also never get refilled. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The trial of three white men charged with last year's killing of a young black man has begun in the U.S. state of Georgia. Prosecutors say that the defendants had killed Ahmad Arbery only based on assumptions.
But in this case, all three of these defendants did everything they did based on assumptions, not on facts, not on evidence, on assumptions. And they made decisions in their driveways based on those assumptions that took a young man's life.
During the trial on Friday, the defendants pleaded not guilty, saying that they thought Arbery might have been fleeing a crime. According to court accounts, the defendants had chased and cornered the 25-year-old victim with their pickup trucks while he was jogging in a mostly white neighborhood in February 2020. One of the defendants then fatally shot him with a shotgun. Arbery's case is one of the many recent racially motivated ones in the U.S. that has fueled nationwide protests. The trial of the accused has also been controversial for its seemingly disproportionate jury, which includes 11 white people and only one black man. South Korea's opposition conservative People Power Party has nominated former prosecutor Yoon Suk-yeol to run for president in March 2022. The ruling Democratic Party in October chose former provincial governor Lee Jae-myung, with the two staking out very different policies in what will likely become a divisive and close contest. Of course, Mona Frank Smith has more from Seoul.
Former prosecutor, anti-corruption maverick, and political novice Yoon Suk-yeol Friday won the nomination to run for president of South Korea for the Conservative People Power Party.
The South Korean people, who want to restore fairness and common sense in our society, have chosen me, a political novice. Instead of happiness, I feel a sense of responsibility and duty to achieve a change of government.
Former provincial governor Lee Jae-myung won the Democratic Party nomination October 10th and proposes a universal basic income among several liberal policies.
Rooting out unfairness, inequality, and corruption, and making a wealthy country where workers are respected are the clear and stern commands from the public.
Early polling shows the candidates running neck and neck.
I support Yoon Suk-yeol because I think that the government of this country ridiculing people should be replaced as soon as possible because lies after lies continue.
The two main candidates for president of South Korea, conservative Yoon Suk-yeol and Democrat Lee Jae-myung, clash on a number of issues, including North Korea policy. Lee favors peace-building engagement with Pyongyang, whereas Yoon advocates strengthening the alliance with the United States through regular military exercises. South Korea's presidential election is slated for March 9th next year, with the winner set to serve a single five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
At least 90 people have died in a fuel tanker explosion in Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown. Authorities in the West African country say the incident occurred in the early hours of Saturday. Tens of people have been injured and transferred to the hospital. The manager of a central morgue in Freetown says they have received the bodies of 91 victims. Freetown's mayor has cited a collision with another truck as the cause of the incident. Footage and videos released on social media also show that a large fire in the area surrounding the tanker. It's the second major fire incident in Sierra Leone's capital this year. In March, over 1,000 people lost their lives amid a fire in the port city slums. And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
We have an urgent matter, namely coronavirus and the issue of health. This has turned into an urgent matter that should be dealt with. Of course, the previous administration made good efforts in the area of health. They carried out good tasks and followed up the matter. They both worked on the production of vaccines inside the country and on the importation of vaccines. There are some rumours here and there, most of which are not true. Good things were done. These measures should be pursued and insisted on. Treatment, preventative measures, healthcare and testing. Testing the possibly infected patients is very important, should receive attention. These issues should definitely be dealt with. Public vaccination is a very important issue which should definitely be carried out. Another issue is imposing a smart lockdown.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I have heard that some Western countries, which have managed to control their infection rates and whose death and infection rates are lower than ours, have closed their borders in a way that they do not even allow the people in their neighboring country, which is also a developed country, but whose rate of infection is high, to come visit their country. In other words, they are careful. We should be really careful about controlling our borders and about preventing the new variants of this disease or other diseases from entering the country, because this is a very important matter. Of course, the people have certain responsibilities as well. As I have frequently said before, our dear people should undertake these four important responsibilities. One is wearing a mask, another is observing social distancing, the third is using good ventilation systems, and the last one is washing hands with soap. These are not difficult tasks. They are all easy. If they observe these, it will definitely be effective in reducing infection, and the high figures of death that ache one's heart will not occur.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
On the 25th of October, Sudan's General Abdel Fattah el-Burhan imposed a nationwide state of emergency across the country and dissolved Abdullah Hamdok's transitional government and the top ruling body, the Sovereign Council, a joint military-civilian power-sharing authority.
First of all, we are declaring a state of emergency. Second, we are dissolving the Sovereign Council and removing the state governors. We remain committed to the international agreements signed during the rule of the interim government.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Now, this week's edition is focusing on the ongoing political crisis in Sudan after the country's military seized power after dissolving a fragile transitional government. Sudan's people have taken to the streets to condemn the coup. In our show today, we are asking, what is the real reason behind the coup, and are foreign powers such as the US, and the Israeli regime involved in fomenting Sudan's political turmoil. Stay with us until the end of the show for the answers.
Sudan in political turmoil. On the 25th of October, the Sudanese military, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, took control of the transitional government in a military coup. Al-Burhan dissolved the military civilian sovereign council that had been established to guide the country to democracy after the overthrow of long-ruling autocrat Omar al-Bashir in a popular uprising 2 years ago. In essence, he staged a palace coup against the government of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and the transitional authority he chaired. Some observers believe that the dispute between the civilian and military leaders in Sudan was exploited to divert the main demands of the Sudanese people.
Following the military takeover, Sudan's main opposition coalition called for civil disobedience and protests across the country. Clashes have rocked Khartoum as Sudan's security forces continue with a crackdown on furious anti-coup protesters. Now to discuss the unfolding situation in Sudan, my colleague contacted Dr. Nisreen El-Amin, a researcher on foreign land grabs and the militarization of borders in East Africa and the Sahel. We also have Adil Abdelati, a Sudanese politician, media activist, and the chairman of the Sudan of the Future political bloc. Now, Dr. El-Amin started by elaborating on what she believes is the real reason behind the military takeover in Sudan.
To answer your question, I would say that there are two reasons that behind this military takeover. One is that Al-Burhan, who is the de facto head of state at the moment, was the head of the Sovereignty Council, which was made up of civilians and military members, was scheduled to hand over power over, you know, it was essentially scheduled to hand over power to the to a civilian member of the Sovereignty Council. And he was unwilling to give up that power, in part because of a fear of being indicted for war crimes that he's responsible for in Darfur, but also during the civil war in South Sudan. The other reason is that there have been conversations within the transitional government that have also led to some of these tensions that I mentioned earlier, because much of the economy is still under the control of military members of the former regime, including Al-Burhan. So currently 250 companies in the areas of gold mining, for example, flour, sesame, and other kind of industries, if you will, are under the control of members of the military. And Hamdok was very much pushing for those companies to be transferred to the government. And so he, you know, Al-Burhan and his deputy Hemeti stood to stand to lose from that kind of transfer.
The actions taken by Sudan's military have many parallels with Egypt's tumultuous summer of 2013. Prime Minister Hamdok and his cabinet ostensibly had responsibility for the day-to-day management of the government. However, their efforts were often been handcuffed by the structure of the transitional government, which favored the military.
Now, our question is, did the civilian leadership place too much trust in the military without learning from other countries, especially neighboring Egypt?
They have succeeded to eliminate all political forces which demanded the giving power to the civilians and a short transitional period. And after 2 months of negotiation, at the beginning, they planned the massacre of the protesters in the sit-in in Khartoum, where hundreds of people were killed at dawn. So that was a way to force other political parties to accept their role in the transitional government. And unfortunately, some of the political parties, they agreed to this and they became partners to them. They succeeded also to arrange the transitional government to be for 3 years, and after that they prolonged this to 4 years.
Well, the coup came hours after U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, held talks with Sudanese military leaders, and this has raised speculation that Washington was aware or actually supported the military takeover. Of course, the U.S. has publicly condemned the coup in Sudan, but this is seen as just a public relations gimmick. Dr. Nesrin gives her take here on the possible role by the United States in the power grab by Sudan's military.
In October, for example, of 2020, Sudan was removed from the state sponsors list, state list of state sponsors of terrorism, and that removal was tied to Sudan being asked to normalize relations with Israel, and that was kind of under the auspices of the United States to position Sudan as kind of to open it up for foreign investment and to allow Sudan to kind of get in the good graces of the international financial institutions and to be able to take out loans and to have its debt, some of it, most of its debt really forgiven. And so that's kind of where the U.S. has been a relatively new player, if you will, because Sudan has been isolated for so long, having been on that list. And so, you know, Feldman met with al-Burhan a few hours before this coup happened or began, and says that he's surprised that it happened. At the same time, you know, al-Burhan had just visited Sisi in Egypt, and it appears that he kind of got the green light to do what he's done. And so what appears to me is that you have U.S. allies in the region like Egypt, like Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
Civilian leaders in Sudan had expressed reservations about the country's normalization with the Israeli regime. For instance, Foreign Minister of the ousted Sudanese Transitional Authority, Maryam al-Sadiq al-Mahdi, downplayed normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Protesters across Sudan also held demonstrations rejecting the move by the Transitional Authority to normalize ties with the Israeli regime, insisting that they will always stand with Palestine.
Most Sudanese oppose the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Well, Mr. Adil believes that the recent coup was most likely instigated by the Israeli regime to pave way for complete normalization.
Israeli factor is very important in this coup. We don't know about direct involvement of Israel in organizing the coup, but they could inspire it or they could promise the military leaders some kind of support. We know that there were a visit from Mossad to Sudan and secret meetings with al-Burhan and with Hemeti in Sudan and in other countries. We know that there were some kind of intelligence support from Israel to the junta in Sudan. We know that the military leaders, al-Burhan himself, and also Hemeti, were very eager to normalize the situation with Israel and to build the diplomatic relations.
While announcing the military takeover, al-Burhan said the military will appoint a technocrat government to lead the country to elections set for July 2023. But he made clear the military will remain in charge in what is seen as following the same script that was used when the military grabbed power in neighboring Egypt.
We're stressing here that the armed forces intend to complete the democratic transition until the country's leadership is handed over to an elected civilian government who can bring these issues to life.
What is the game plan of the military rulers? Can we expect Sudan to move to a military rule similar to the one in Egypt?
People on the streets have a very clear message that they will not be governed by any government that is formed by al-Burhan and the military remnants of the al-Bashir regime. And I don't think they're going to be leaving the streets until their demands are met. And so, to me, the comparisons with Egypt are not ones I would like to make. I'm hopeful and very proud of the people who are risking their lives on the street, who are defending this revolution. And I do think that Burhan and his sort of, you know, and his crew, if you will, that their days are numbered.
Several people have been killed after security forces clashed with protesters furious over the military coup. Well, we shall now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about how the United Nations and the African Union reacted to the coup in Sudan. So stay with us.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Sudan in political turmoil.
The military coup in Sudan has attracted widespread condemnation internationally. The United Nations has led calls for restoration of civilian rule in the country.
The Secretary General strongly condemns the ongoing military coup d'etat in Khartoum and all actions that could jeopardize Sudan's political transition and stability. The Secretary General calls for the immediate reconstitution of the governing arrangements provided under the constitutional document. Sudanese stakeholders must immediately return to dialogue and engage in good faith to restore the constitutional order and Sudan's transitional process. The United Nations reiterates its unwavering commitment and support to the realization of Sudan's political transition. Any attempt to undermine the transition process puts at risk Sudan's security, stability, and development.
The African Union has said it suspended Sudan from all its activities after the country's military overthrew the civilian-led transitional government. The continent-wide bloc said it strongly condemns the seizure of power and was suspending Sudan from all AU activities until the effective restoration of the civilian-led transitional authority. This move by the African Union was similar to other measures in the wake of military coups in the continent.
Mr. Adil believes that failure by the African Union to take tangible action against coup leaders will affect the credibility of this pan-African organization.
The African Union failed the African people in preventing military leaders from gaining power and in dealing with coups like in Mali, like in Guinea, and in other countries now in Sudan. And the position of the African Union is very, very weak. That is because the African Union almost consisted of different countries which are ruled by military leaders. And it is an organization of official countries and official government. So this is that is the reason why their positions are very weak. The Sudanese people are not looking anymore for the African Union to defend them. Rather, they are relying on themselves and on some limited international support.
The transitional authority led by General Burhan had pledged to cooperate with the International Criminal Court, which has issued arrest warrants for Bashir for alleged war crimes in the restive Darfur region. However, the pursuit of justice over Darfur was a point of tension between the military and civilian leaders.
The military has always appeared reluctant in taking action on the thorny issue of handing Bashir over to the ICC to be charged with crimes against humanity. The question many are asking is, will this file be closed after the coup?
I think in many ways, as I said earlier, Al-Burhan has been resistant to hand over power to a civilian member of the Sovereignty Council, in part because he fears being indicted for similar war crimes, right, that al-Bashir has been indicted for by the ICC. And so, you know, in some ways, I think it might be, we might have to sort of think about that file is closed, but it's also unclear. I mean, they've thrown al-Bashir under the bus before, so.
In late 2019, a Sudanese court convicted former President Omar al-Bashir on corruption charges and sentenced him to 2 years of detention in a reform facility. Many analysts, including Adil, believe the sentence was lenient due to the influence of Bashir within the military.
Bashir is a mentor of these generals. He was their commander of chief for 30 years, and they are very connected to him. Also, they are afraid that Bashir will become a witness against them if he's handed to the international criminal law, and he will bring them by witnessing also against them as partners in the crimes. So they will never give him, and they will never give him even a good trial in Sudan for his crimes against humanity, for genocide, and for war crimes.
General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and other Sudanese military leaders have close ties to Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. It's clearly not in the interest of these countries to see a democratic Sudan.
The U.S. is trying to distort and misdirect the popular revolutionary movement in Sudan to prevent similar movements from gaining popularity in Arab regimes allied to Washington. So what role, if any, did regional powers such as Egypt, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia play in the current military takeover in Sudan?
I mean, they're probably the more major players. And I think one of the things to remember is that al-Burhan, he was trained in a military college in Egypt, has strong ties to Sisi, and was always seen as, he also actually played an important role in supporting the Saudi coalition to fight in the war in Yemen. And so I think at that time we saw al-Burhan and others emerge as kind of more loyal allies to the Saudi UAE-Egypt kind of coalition. And they actually pledged, as soon as al-Bashir was ousted, Saudi Arabia and the UAE immediately pledged about $2 billion in aid to support the Transitional Military Council before the partnership and the transitional government was formed. So right there you see that they've always been very supportive of the military elements of this government.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up for today. I would like to thank our guest, Dr. Nisreen El-Amin, a researcher on foreign land grabs and militarization of borders in East Africa and the Sahel, and also Adil Abdelati, a Sudanese politician and chairman of the Sudan of the Future political bloc. Here at Africa Today, we shall continue giving you an alternative view of events taking place in Africa. And that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your views. From me, Mubarak Kenya, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Today's great tip, what are the secrets that the Salik, the spiritual wayfarer on this journey of Ubudiyyah, must take in order to reach an ultimate level of servitude to Allah? Now, dear listeners, we've been talking about various things in various programs. Just as a very humble reminder, it is important to be able to listen to all of these programs so that we have a nice comprehensive understanding of all the different things that can be done in order to enhance, increase, and strengthen our ubudiyyah, our worship to Allah. Now, of course, we talked about one of the things which is necessary, which was humility. Another one of the things which is necessary for this spiritual wayfarer, this salik, as is known in Arabic, on this path of the servitude to Allah and the ubudiyyah to Allah, this salik needs to have one thing among all the others in their worships, and in the worships, most specifically in the salah, the daily prayers that are done. Just as a quick side note, of course, salah is known in the traditions and in the Quran and in the words of the spiritual masters on the path of the ubudiyyah to Allah. Salah is considered the head, the chief of all worships and all ibadat, as it is known in Arabic. And the salah is known to have the position of comprehensiveness, jami'iyat. It has this all-inclusive aspect within it. So what we're saying is that if you want to strengthen and enhance your ubudiyyah to Allah, your servitude to Allah, then the salah, the daily prayers, and even the recommended prayers are the main ingredient to enhance this ubudiyyah. Now, within the salah, we talked about humility when it comes to the worship and ubudiyyah of Allah. And so in this program, we're going to talk about another thing which is necessary in the salah for our ubudiyyah to Allah, and that is something which is called submissiveness, submission. Arabic, it is sometimes known as khushu. This humbleness, submissiveness, this reverence which is there. Now, in fact, it can be said that a complete kind of submission, khudu, khushu, and khudu also is another variant of this concept of submission and submissiveness and reverence and honoring and humility, which is all mixed with one another. This submission in itself is mixed with love and fear. The love of Allah and the fear of the disobedience and the wrath and the anger of Allah, of course, which comes about due to our disobedience and our arrogance and pride and so forth. Now, this submission to Allah, this khushu, and this submissiveness, which again is mixed with a balance of love and fear, this is a result of comprehending the greatness and the power and the majesty and the beauty and the glory of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is farstoday.com.
Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Khaifin, the Whispered Prayer of the Fearful. Please stay with me.
نهاري دونكم ليل وليلي كله أنا العبد الفقير أنا غرامي أنتم علىنا.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, do you blacken faces which fall down in prostration before your mightiness? Do you strike dumb tongues which speak in laudation of your glory and majesty? Do you seal hearts which harbor your love? Do you deafen ears which take pleasure in hearing your remembrance according to your will? Do you manacle hands which expectations have raised to you in hope of your clemency? Do you punish bodies which work to obey you until they grew thin in struggling for you? Do you chastise legs which ran to worship you?
وفي طلب الرضا منكم له الغايات تتفق أبيث سادتي صبا يذوب بكم وينمحق وفي طلب الرضا منكم له الغايات تتفق أن العبد الفقير على غرام أنتم علىنا.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We're talking about a certain aspects or certain attributes that a spiritual wayfarer, a salik, must have when they are upon the path of the ubudiyya and the obedience and the worship to Allah. Now, when we're talking about certain attributes that are necessary, we talked about how submissiveness, submission, this reverence, which is done for Allah, it is mixed with love and fear. And of course, this love and fear is because we start to realize, acquire the knowledge and the ma'arifa, the knowledge of the greatness and the power and the majesty and the glory of Allah the Mighty, the Exalted. Now, the reason it is mixed with either love or fear, and the best is to have a mix, a balance of both love and fear. Now, this is because generally the hearts of the people of this spiritual wayfaring, and of course the hearts of people in general, are different according to their dispositions and their natures, right? So what this means is that some of the people's hearts are amorous and they are in love with the manifestations of the beauty, the jamal of Allah. And so driven by this innate nature, this fitra, these people are attracted to the beauty of the beloved. They are attracted to the beauty and the majesty and the glory of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. And now, these specific people who they have a tendency to have more love in their hearts, they comprehend even the shadow of the beautiful Allah. Or they witness that Allah is the origin of beauty. They see that the greatness of Allah is hidden and even apparent in the secret of the beauty of Allah. These people are filled with the manifestations and they see the manifestations of Allah. They go into this rapture, for in every beauty there is a hidden glory, and in every glory there is a hidden beauty. And so, dear friends, it is when we start to see the beauty of Allah in the things around us, in the events around us, that we truly feel and we become submissive. This khushu is created within us when we are overpowered by the manifestations of the beauty of Allah.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is farstoday.com.
رجائي بالرضا والخير، أنير طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
And now we will listen to Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami, who will talk about today's topic.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. As we said in Surah Taha, verse number 14, إنني أنا الله لا إله إلا أنا فاعبدني وأقم الصلاة لذكري. The second part of the verse where Almighty God says فاعبدني, worship me. We believe that God is one. We acknowledge as Muslims the monotheistic belief in Almighty God, His uniqueness, and all of the other attributes that come along with Tawheed. It's very important for us to know the different